I'm Pedro. I'll be teaching you this course together with Kevin. So the way it's going to work is that I'll be giving the first week from a more physical perspective, and then Kevin will take over and cover some more mathematically oriented approach to exactly solvable models, or to so-called integrable models, which are a particular class of models in two dimensions that can be very rich and allow us to learn things about quantum field theory in general and about higher dimensional field theory sometimes. And we like them as theoretical physicists for a simple reason, that they can often be exactly solved. So we can often look at exact analytic solutions and play with the various parameters, extract physics out of these models, and really get to access physical insight in a very pure way that often, when we need to resort to approximations and other methods, it's a little bit trickier to see. Very good. So I'll start by a few comments then on the kind of physics that we might encounter. And in particular, when we discuss physics and put a physical model, one of the first things we ask is, what are the excitations? What are the particles in your model? What particles do we have? So I would like to make a few comments about particles. Okay? So I'd like to introduce a few different physical models, some simple systems, where what we call a particle can change quite a lot. So the first example I would like to introduce, where what we call particle might be a little bit unusual, is when the particle is what we call magnon. So this is a particular type of particles that we call magnons that I will now just briefly introduce. So the idea of these magnons, they appear in what are called spin chains. So a spin chain, it's a sequence of spins up, you get the point. And then maybe there is one spin that is down. Up. Right? So suppose we have this kind of spin chain and this spin here is down. Now I could imagine that this spin, which normally is at some position n in my one-dimensional spin chain, perhaps this guy, this spin flip, could move with some momentum p and some energy e of p. The spins are not moving, but the spin down could be. It's a little bit like these Mexican waves in the stadium, where everyone would be with, okay, normally it's the opposite. Everyone is with the hands down, and then one person puts the hands up, and then the next, and then the next. And of course, people are not moving, but the wave is moving, right? Right, up, and then the next one up, and then the next one up, and so on. And without anyone moving, there is this Mexican wave moving, this excitation traveling. So let's see in a little bit more detail how this would work. Let's write a spin chain Hamiltonian. So let's write an Hamiltonian, which would be something like this. We would sum over all positions in my lattice. And then I would say that there is a spin at position n that could interact with spin at position n plus 1. This is the only interaction I could write between neighborhood spins. If both are up, sigma z times sigma, if both are up, this would give 1. So just for normalization, I subtract the identity, just so that this gives 0 acting on up. And if I want the vacuum to be the ferromagnetic vacuum, I would put some minus lambda, where this lambda is positive. This would ensure that the vacuum is the ferromagnetic vacuum, where all spins are up, or all spins are pointing in the same direction. Because when they have opposite spins, if they would have opposite spins, this would cost some energy because lambda is positive. Right? Is it clear? So it's best that all of them are aligned. Now, by this dot, of course, when I have a dot, and I have A dot B, I mean the z component of A, the z component of B, plus the plus component of A, the minus component of B, the minus component of A, and the B component of B. Where in terms of Pauli matrices, as you remember, sigma plus would be just this guy, right? That flips a down spin into an up spin, and similarly for sigma minus. Okay? Now, the Hamiltonian then, right? The Hamiltonian acting on an excitation at position n, let's say that this I call an excitation at position n. The Hamiltonian acting on H, what will it do? Whenever it acts on a pair of indices of spins, like here or here, it gives zero if they have the same alignment, right? Because if they are up, sigma z gives one, but this guy, one of them kills the state. You agree? And because this gives one, it cancels with a minus one, as we said. So when it acts on plus, it always gives zero until it reaches the interesting part, which is when the Hamiltonian acts here or here. This is the interesting part. Everywhere else, it gives zero. And when it acts here, what happens? Here, when I act sigma z, I get one times minus one, so I get minus one. So now they no longer cancel. when I act here, right? When I act here, the sigma z part. And what about the sigma plus part? The sigma plus part would remove the spin here and put it here. The sigma plus acting here and sigma minus acting here flips the position of the two excitations. Okay? So the claim is that what we get is minus lambda. There are two terms that move the spin. So the spin can move to position n minus 1, or it could move to position n plus 1 if the Hamiltonian is acting on the next two sides. Okay? Or we have the sigma z term, which gives minus 2 times n. Okay? Now I'm doing this now, and I'm realizing there is a factor of 2 that I got wrong. So this formula that I wrote now is correct, but it's probably not compatible with what I wrote here. Let me make sure I have things correct. So when I act with sigma z, I subtract 1. That's correct. Now, if I do, just give me a second. There might be a 1/2 missing here, right? When I have x, y, this is correct. But when I translate to plus minus, is this correct or am I missing a 1/2 here? Let me check. So z give minus 1, and minus 1 is minus 2. Okay, let me think 1 second. Okay. Sorry, I already screwed up here some factors of 2. So let me see what's the simplest way to fix it in real time. So I'll do it in a different color because I'm fixing mistakes. I think probably here there is a 2. Here there is a 2. And here. Yeah, and here I want a 1/2, and I want to put a 1/2 here, and then this equation is true. Sorry about that. Can someone tell me if this is correct or not? Did someone do this in their notepads? Is this statement correct? There is a 2 missing here. So you agree that this is equal AZ BZ plus AX BX plus AY BY, right? I'm asking if from going from here to here if I got a factor of 2 missing. I think I did, yeah. I think this is. Oh, well, okay.
Yes, there is a 2 missing there. I calculated it, yes.
This is correct, right?
Twos are correct.
Those twos are correct? Okay, and then this is my definition. Good, thank you. Okay, so we are saved. Okay. But now, what I want to see is that you see that what the Hamiltonian does. It acts on the position and moves, hops the excitation. It either moves to the left or it moves to the right. Right? So it means that if I act with H, if I give my excitation some momentum, which means I define a state with one excitation to be a linear superposition e to the I momentum times n times excitation at position n, right? I gave my excitation some momentum p. What H does is it acts here by shifting n, but then I can reshift the summation, and I get, therefore, when I do it, minus lambda 2 cosine of p minus 2 times the state psi. Right? So I conclude that the energy of my excitation, epsilon of p, indeed, we can compute, and it is just minus lambda 2 cosine of p minus 2. Which behaves, if you see, when p is very small, it behaves as lambda p squared. It vanishes quadratically when p is going to 0. Okay. So first, is it clear? So this excitation has some momentum p, its energy epsilon of p, and this is an example that I would call of a particle. It's a magnon, which is an excitation around the ferromagnetic vacuum of a spin chain. Okay? Now, you see that this operation here, is like a discrete Laplacian, right? Where instead of a second derivative, we say we move to the left, move to the right, subtract twice n. So it's like a discrete Laplacian. And that is why it's no surprise that when the momentum is very small, which means that we are considering long wavelengths and don't see the discrete nature of the lattice, we get just the usual p square, which is the usual momentum of an unrelativistic particle. Right? So this is natural because since we do not see the lattice. So it's a little bit of an example where we have some lattice, right? But some long wavelength excitation, and therefore the lattice details are not seen, and we get an unrelativistic excitation. Okay? Okay. Any question here? So this would be a magnon. Now, if you see the magnon, the SZ, the total spin, the SZ, how much does it change when we put a magnon? Yes?
What would it... so this will also have a P4 correction term.
That's right.
And it is suppressed in usual continuous systems because...
So the P square when P is small, P to the 4 is just much smaller. It's just
so
that.
You mean the kinetic energy formula is approximate?
This is the exact dispersion relation. This is an approximation. This is the exact one. So this is what's called the dispersion relation. It's what is epsilon as function of P. So it's a particular particle. The fact that there is this periodicity is because we are on a lattice. Now, how much does the spin Z component change by putting a magnon? You see, by how much does it change? we have, instead of a spin up, a spin down. So instead of spin 1/2, we have spin minus 1/2. So the total spin changes by minus 1, right? Which is minus 1/2 minus 1/2. Right? So it, the total, so we say that the magnon carries spin minus 1. So it carries 1 unit of spin. Okay, minus 1 or plus 1 is convention. I just chose the vacuum to be all spins up. So it carries 1 unit of spin. Because that's the fundamental move. I can do a spin flip. Right? And because I do a spin flip, what was a spin up, now it's a spin down. So the total spin difference is minus 1. So here is the identity card of a magnon. A magnon is an excitation. Here is its spin. This is how much spin it carries. And here is its dispersion relation, right? So you give a card, okay, here is my dispersion relation, here is my spin. Okay, that's the description of a magnon. Good. Another particle I would like to introduce is what's called a spinon. The spinon is the same model where lambda is negative. Now, if lambda is negative, the great difference is that the vacuum is what's called the antiferromagnetic vacuum. Because now the spins want to be anti-aligned. So instead of everyone up, the vacuum would be something like up, down, up, down, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, plus many other cats. I mean, it's not this state, up, up, down, down, up, down. So it's basically a huge mess. The vacuum is a very complicated state. It's a singlet. It has as many spins up as spin down. So it's a state where the total Z component is equal to zero. It has as many spins up as spins down. But it's a very complicated state. There's no simple picture that I can write for this antiferromagnetic state. It's not the so-called nil state that would be the vacuum in higher dimensions. So here it's a very complicated entangled state, a combination of many, many cats. So because it's very complicated, I just say, okay, there is some vacuum which is complicated. So I put the complication, I put like this. You see? Just a mess.
Your Hamiltonian is just counting a certain positive energy whenever two spins are aligned and a negative energy when they're not aligned, right?
Right now, there is the energy is negative when they are aligned because of the minus sign. So if lambda is positive, they want to be aligned. If lambda is negative, they want to be anti-aligned.
Yes, so why is up, up, down, down good?
No, look, you could say, let me try this state. Is this an eigenstate? It's not. Because when I act with the Hamiltonian here, these guys move. So I don't get back this state.
Yes.
So even though you would say this looks better than this because they are anti-aligned at every step, this is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. I act with Hamiltonian here, and I hop this spin, right? I swap these two. And therefore, if I want it to be an eigenstate, I better put a bit of this state to cancel that. But then this is also not an eigenstate, and I need to put another one. And the full state that is indeed an eigenstate, and which is a minimal state, of course contains these cats, but it has to contain many other cats. And this is just not an eigenstate. Act with Hamiltonian here, you don't get this state times some energy, right? So this cannot be the answer. So then you need to consider a little bit when these two guys are swapped. But then, what about swapping here? Okay, so I also need that. And I also need, and at the end of the day, you get just a big, 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 huge mess. Okay? For example, just to give you an idea, the energy of the ferromagnetic vacuum is zero because we chose this identity carefully, or not very carefully, because I was struggling with factors of two, but almost carefully, right? And the energy of the ferromagnetic is zero. And with this convention, the energy of the antiferromagnetic vacuum, now it's physical because it's a delta energy, is lambda. Lambda is negative, so okay, I have to fix. Lambda times 4 log 2 times L, where L is the number of sites of my spin chain. This is for L large. Okay. So you see it's a non-trivial number, it's for log 2. Okay. We'll find this number after tomorrow, probably. Okay. And now we ask, okay, we have this messy vacuum. And let me say, let me suppose I consider psi, where psi now is the first excited state. With momentum P and energy epsilon of P. Right? So I just look at the spectrum and I say this is the vacuum. And now the first excited state, I want to think of it like I have my vacuum and I have some excitation. It can be a little bit messy and so on, but there will be some excitation that will have some momentum P. And it will move in this vacuum with some momentum P. Right? If I do it, this will be the excitations of my model. Okay? This guy is what is called a spinon. And it's much harder to visualize simply because the vacuum itself is already hard to visualize, let alone the excitation. Okay? But we can ask, okay, let me compute the first excited state, compute the energy as function of P, and see what I get. What you get is that the energy is lambda minus lambda times 2 pi cosine of P. It's a non-trivial function now of P, you see. This is what you get. And this would be the dispersion relation of this spinon. Okay? And this spinon, just to give you an idea, just to tell you something that you will find surprising, we start with the antiferromagnetic vacuum that has Sz equal to 0. And then this spinon carries spin 1/2 and not 1.
Okay? Why?
And this is very surprising, right? Because we start with spin 0. And then what we can do is flip a spin. That's the only thing we can do in our Hilbert space. So we can have spin 0. Spin 1, spin 2, spin 3, we cannot have half integer spins. Okay? So this phenomena, where normally we should only be able to go in steps of integer, and I'm telling you, no, you go in steps of half integer, is what is called, it's a phenomenon, and it's called fractionalization. And a priori, it looks crazy. How could we have something with spin 1/2? We don't have states of spin Sz equal 3/2 or 5/2. And the solution to this paradox is that these spinons are always produced in an even number. And because they are always produced in an even number, we don't reach a contradiction where we would get out of the Hilbert space. So these guys are produced, can only exist in the Hilbert space in an even number, and that's why we don't reach a problem with the Hilbert space. So roughly, it's some emergent excitation, a more complicated excitation that we will study after tomorrow, I think, and which has this funny phenomenon of fractionalization. So you see that we have the same theory, where here a very simple vacuum and a very simple excitation, and there, a very complicated vacuum and a complicated excitation. Okay? Yes?
Should I treat a pair as two spinons or a spinon and then anti-spinon?
Two spinons. Okay. Okay. Questions here? So I'll continue this survey of particles and physical models just to give us an idea of the kind of things we are going to see. And then I'll summarize a little bit what we have seen so far.
Why is it not possible to just flip one? Why does
those come in pairs? So the vacuum SSC equals 0. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, if I look at the next state, at the other states in the Hilbert space close to the vacuum, they have spin either spin equals 0 or Because why there are other states with spin equals zero? Because there are many, many singlet states, right? So of course I won't have just a vacuum, right? Singlets, I can make singlets out of L spins, gazillions of them, right? So there are many states of spin zero. And you can also have state of spin one, which is the case where there are two more spins down compared to spins up, right? But you don't have state of spin one half, right? So the point is, indeed, the next states in the Hilbert space, they have either spin zero or spin one, which correspond in this picture to producing pairs of these spinets. If I produce a pair of particles of spin 1/2, if these particles are both pointing up, I change the spin. If one is up and one is down, I don't change the total spin, but I do change the energy. So we'll see that these particles really carry spin. They are spinners. They carry spin 1/2. And a little bit of a way to think is that you flip the spin, so you create an excitation of spin 1. But that excitation kind of broke apart into two excitations of spin 1/2. So it's a little bit like some deconfinement. You create an excitation, but that was not the correct degree of freedom, and it deconfined into two excitations of spin 1/2. And this is this phenomenon known as fractionalization.
So what are the raising or lowering operators which give us the whole Hilbert space?
I'll describe it tomorrow. So here, it's a sequence of just applying. You start with everyone up, right? And now you can apply sigma minus at each of the positions. And in this way, you build the full Hilbert space, right? So the dimension of the Hilbert space, at each site, I can choose if I have spin up or down. So the total dimension is 2 to the L. And I can obtain this Hilbert space by starting with everyone up and flipping any of the spins, so with sigma minus at position n. Another question is, what is the operator that I act on the vacuum to get an excitation of momentum p? And then I act twice and I get two excitations, and then three times. And that's a more complicated set of creation operators that I'll describe tomorrow. And yet a more complicated question is, what about here? Can I construct a vacuum and then some creation operators? And the answer is, in some sense, yes, but there is a better way to think about that side, which makes use of the fact that we can solve this exactly. And then think of that as a very excited state of this type.
So I guess it's obvious to you why we should only have integer spins in total. It's not obvious to me.
So the point is that if this spin z is equal to zero, okay, so here I have to be a little bit more careful. So let this spin z be equal to zero. Of course, here I'm assuming that L is even, such that I can have as many up as down. Otherwise, the total spin will be half integer. So let's suppose L is even. Then I have the total spin is equal to zero. Now, what can I do? So the total spin equal to zero means that the number of spin up is equal to the number of spin down. Right? Now, if I change, I get one more of this and one less of this. So I always change by an integer, because I remove 1/2 and I put 1/2. So the total change is always an integer, right? Similarly there, I start with everyone up, so the total spin is L times 1/2. And then whenever I change by 1, right? So the fundamental spin flip changes by 1. Now let's continue considering particles that I imagine that you have not seen or have not thought much about. Now let's move gears and go from spin chains. Yes?
Yeah, so usually people define a particle as like an excitation of a ground state or something.
Right, right. That's how I did it here as well, right?
But there, an excitation is two particles. So
right, this is a model where there are no single particle excitations.
Sure, but in that model then I'm just wondering, what's a particle? Like, what is a spin on?
Well, if a spin chain is very large, though, what would happen is that you would have to produce them in pairs, because you can imagine, because that's the only thing that exists in the Hilbert space, but then they move very separated because they are not confined, and you can observe really independently what they are.
But produce what in pairs? What's a spin on?
A spin on is an excitation with momentum p, in the sense that the energy of the state, so you can imagine that the energy of a state with n spinons, where n is even, because that's the only thing that can be produced in a spin chain, would be equal to the sum from j equal 1 up to n of epsilon of the momenta of spinon j. So the spectrum organizes itself in the sense that I have some long spin chain, and the spectrum of my model is just the energy of the various excitations that move in this spin chain. And once I see that this is the form of the spectrum, I call these excitations particles. Is it clear?
I'd like to continue the question out of curiosity. For example, if we have the second excitation, which means four spinons, is there any invariant that can that will tell us which one is created as pair with which one? Or
no. No, there is no such notion.
Okay.
It's a complicated entangled state. You see, spinons should look like something mysterious. What is this fractionalization and so on? I'm not pretending that you will understand the details about spinons from this blackboard. It's just a teaser. I'm going to tell about spinons after tomorrow in detail. And you will see what a spinon is with formulas, not with cartoonish messes, right? Now let's move to quantum field theory. And let's talk yet about another type of particle that you might not be totally familiar with. Let's consider a Lagrangian called the Lagrangian of Sine-Gordon theory. This Lagrangian is the following. So we are in two dimensions. So we have dx dt, or rather this is the action. We have dx dt. And let's suppose you have a scalar, 1 half d phi squared. And then let's suppose we have minus a potential, which would be some periodic potential like this. Okay, it's called Sine-Gordon because the equations of motion, if I take derivative of cosine, I get sine. It's box phi equals sine phi. So that's called Sine-Gordon equation. Now, you see that in this Sine-Gordon equation, you could imagine that the vacuum could correspond to phi equal to 0. If I put phi equal to 0, that's a minimum of my potential, and that could correspond to the vacuum. But of course, because of this periodicity, phi is basically the same as phi plus 2 pi, or lambda, right? Because of the periodicity of the cosine. So is the vacuum phi equal to 0 or phi equal to pi over lambda? I say it doesn't matter much, right? Because it's just a redefinition of phi. If you say phi equal to 0, if I tell you that, no, I prefer this as the vacuum, you say, okay, psi tilde is this plus psi, and you plug, and you get the same action for psi tilde, right? So who cares about that? Well, the point is that we could have changes from one vacuum to the other, and that does matter. So we could imagine a configuration of phi where phi is equal to 0, 0, 0, 0, and then at some point changes to 2 pi over lambda. Right? Now, in all this region from minus infinity to plus infinity, in all this region here, the energy is equal to 0. And in all this region here, the energy is equal to 0. And here, because this is a small region, I have some energy. Energy here is of order 1. Right? Now, therefore, this state has energy bigger than just phi equal to 0. However, to go from this state to the state of phi equal to 0 requires an infinite amount of energy, because I would have to lower all this to phi equal to 0. That costs a lot of energy. So even though this has energy of order 1, this is what is called protected by topological reasons. Because I have phi equals 0 going to phi equal to pi, and I cannot just lower this because it costs an infinite amount of energy. Okay? A way to visualize it that I like a lot is to think of phi as an angle to the vertical direction. And then we start with phi equal to 0, and we have like a bunch of spins like this. And then phi starts increasing, so this starts bending with respect to the vertical direction, you see? And rotating, and rotating, and rotating. Until it's again pointing up, but it's like a belt that you twist and then you stretch to infinity, you cannot untwist the belt. Right? You can move the twist. You can push, right, the twist of the belt. Right? If you put the belt wrongly, you can move it, but you cannot, and you cannot get rid of the twist of the belt, right? So this excitation here, which is the same as this, right? So this is the same as this. Is an excitation that can move with momentum P and some energy EFP. In this case, one can compute, and we get square root of m squared plus p squared, which is a relativistic excitation. I used here capital M and not small m, because this is not the small, the m that appears there. This is a different type of excitation. It's called the soliton in quantum field theory, and this soliton moves. It's a domain wall between phi equals 0 and phi equals 2 pi and moves, and this is its dispersion relation. Okay? So this particle, we call it pink psi, and it's a relativistic excitation with this dispersion relation.
Sorry, this is a new constant m, or is it possible to write in terms of the other one?
It's possible to find it in terms of the other one.
M lambda?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's kind of complicated.
Okay.
So this is the kink psi. And we could imagine another excitation, which would be the opposite. And this would be the anti-kink psi bar. And the name kink and anti-kink, it's obvious, because now if we have a kink and an anti-kink, they can annihilate now. Now it doesn't cost an infinite amount of energy if they would like to annihilate. Because now I go 0, 2 pi, 0 again. Now I can reduce this small piece of 2 pi. Right? Okay, so we put a bar here to indicate anti-kink, and it has the same dispersion relation, of course. But now you can also imagine, right? So these guys are what are called solitons, and they are another type of particle that we can have in quantum field theory, some non-perturbative solutions that move, and in this case they are protected by topological reasons. Right, so these are protected by topology. Now you can ask. Yes?
So you are calling these states, but there are there solution of the Sine-Gordon equation?
Yes. Classically, they are solutions of Sine-Gordon equation.
For each solution, you call a state, and
So quantum mechanically, they exist.
Yeah.
But they also exist classically. Classically, I would just write the equations of motion.
Yeah.
And let's try to find a solution that goes from 0 to 2 pi over lambda.
This is position?
And this would be the position, yeah?
Okay.
This is position.
At some instant.
And at some instant of time, and as time evolves, this wall moves. So I ask, can I find a solution like that? Like some arctangent of x minus vt, where v is the velocity of this wall.
Yeah.
And indeed, you can solve the equations of motion and find that the classical level, this soliton. Right? And then you'd ask, what happens if I quantize around them and if I study their quantum behavior? Okay, now you can ask, what about localized perturbations that are not these solitonic ones, where I just have phi goes to phi plus delta phi, where this delta phi is some localized excitation? Not some big topological thing, but a standard thing that we imagine as an excitation, right? That's the normal thing that we would guess. I write phi equals phi plus delta phi, and I quantize this delta phi. No, of course you can also do. And this guy is called a breather. And it is just a fundamental excitation of phi, just the usual excitation of phi. But it's called a breather. And one of the reasons why it's called a breather is that this guy, I can actually think of it as being made out of a kink and an anti-kink. Even though it's the fundamental excitation of psi, I can actually think of it as being a bound state of a kink and anti-kink. It's like the kink and anti-kink attract and form a molecule that is vibrating. And that's because of this vibration, that's why it's called a breather, because it looks like it's breathing. And then it moves, breathing, like moving to the right. This bound state of kink, anti-kink. Okay? And this is the fundamental excitation of the theory. It can also be thought of as a bound state of kink and anti-kink. So you see yet another type of particle that we are seeing here, domain walls, kinks, and also breathers, which can be thought as bound states or fundamental excitations of my quantum field theory. Okay, good. So we are seeing that. Let's go on and study and see some other examples. Okay. As the fourth example, I would like to introduce. Is it 1 hour or an hour and a half, this lecture?
It's 1 hour.
Okay, good. So it's fine. So the other example I would like to introduce is the so-called ON nonlinear sigma model.
But there are no lectures after this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good, very good. I would never go over time, as people know, but okay, with this endorsement, okay. But no, but I will not go over time. So let's suppose we have the ON nonlinear sigma model. So that's a funny quantum field theory, where the field is a vector n, okay, which has components n1 up to nn. So it has n components. That's where the ON comes from. It's a vector under ON. And this vector is in a sphere. So n square is equal to 1. Okay? So it describes a vector in a sphere. So what is the path integral for this model? So I integrate over vectors n, right? Now I will let some space because I will write something here. E to the I, okay, I or minus depends if we don't Euclidean or not, but let's suppose we do Euclidean. Okay. Let me make a comment here because some people sometimes get a bit confused by this, and I don't want anyone to be confused. This model here, I could have written it in the following way. I could have written it as in the following way. I put 1 over lambda here in front, okay? And I remove the lambda from here, okay? This is the same. Okay, this is equivalent. And it's very simple, it's just that I can rescale phi, and as I rescale phi by 1 over lambda, 1 over lambda square, I rescale phi by 1 over lambda, 1 over lambda goes here, and I remove from here, and I remove by here. Okay, it's clear? So, on the other hand, why did we write it like this? Because written like this, look, this part as an expansion of the form m square pi square over 2 minus m square over 4 factorial pi to the 4 times lambda square plus dot dot dot. So in this way of writing, it's obvious that lambda is a coupling. The quartic vertex comes with lambda, the cyclic vertex comes with lambda 4, and so on and so forth. When people write like this, where lambda appears as an overall factor, some people think that it's not obvious that this lambda is a coupling. Because now lambda disappeared from here and only appears outside. So when lambda appears just overall multiplying the Lagrangian, it's always a coupling, just because you can redefine phi to have a canonical two-point function, and then lambda appears in the interactions, right? It's clear? Because here that's how I want to write it. I want to put lambda outside. So lambda is the coupling. Then we have a kinetic term, dn square. So just so that I hope this is absolutely clear, but this means D, T, okay. Right, okay, so this means D, T, N, A, D, T, N, A, minus D, X, N, A, D, X, N, A, sum from A equals 1 up to N, right? So D, N square, but N is a unit vector, right? N is a unit vector. So how would you implement that N is a unit vector? Well, you could put a Lagrange multiplier plus lambda. Lambda is a field as well that says that N square must be equal to 1, right? So I'm just using the usual statement that integral e to the I px dp is just delta of x. So if I add a Lagrange multiplier and I integrate also over this field lambda, I ensure that n squared is equal to 1. Right? Now, this model here is strongly coupled. Contrary to this one, where if I start studying excitations of phi, I say that this term is very small, the other term is very small, and I can get just a free scalar where I have a propagator and then I start doing perturbation theory. This model is strongly coupled. There is no starting point where things are free. Okay? Let me illustrate this for you by looking at the equations of motion. If I look at the equations of motion here, I get box phi plus m squared phi equal, and then stuff which have lambda. So if I put lambda equal to 0, I just get box phi plus m squared phi equals 0, right? Do you agree? But let's see what we get here. So what are the equations of motion here? So let's write the equations of motion for this theory. And the equations of motion, so I take derivative with respect to derivative of the Lagrangian, so I get d mu of d mu n, right? So that's equal to the derivative with respect to n, which give me lambda n. So these are the equations of motion. Now, on the other hand, we have that n square equal to 1. This is the equation of motion for lambda, if you want. So this is the equation of motion for n. And the equation of motion for lambda, which is just a constraint that n square equal to 1. Right? If I vary with respect to lambda, and also because I know I have this delta function constraint. Now, because n square equal to 1, this implies that n dot d mu n equal to 0, because I just take derivative of this constraint. And if I take a second derivative, this implies that n dot, if the derivative x here, I get box of n. And if the derivative x here, I get dn square equal to 0. So it means that I can dot this equation with n. Here I get 1. Here I get n dot box n. But n dot box n I can replace by dn square. So lambda is minus dn square. I find. So by dotting with n, so I take this equation, I dot it with n, I find what's lambda, and the final equation I get for the equation of motion is box n plus dn square n equal to 0. So these are the equations of motion for my unit vector. Okay? Is it clear? So you see that these equations of motion, it's not like the ones we are used to, right? So just to emphasize again, the equations of motion we would get here, the equations of motion would be box phi minus m square phi equal to lambda square phi cube over 3 plus a bunch of terms. So when lambda equal to, which And phi is therefore the propagator acting on this stuff, and I can solve perturbatively, right? When lambda equal to zero, I just get a free scalar. Not here. Here, the beginning, there's no parameter, and the starting equations are very nonlinear and complicated, right? So there is no starting point. It looks like I don't even know how to start, right? So let's try to proceed. Let's try to advance a little bit. To have so here it looks like I don't even know the starting point. It's even hard to tell what's a particle. But actually, we can get some inspiration by integrating out n in this path integral. You see that n, if I integrate out n, I will get integral over this Lagrange multiplier times exponential of some effective action that depends for lambda upon integrating out this vector n. Okay. So how do we integrate out n? So what is this effective action here? This effective action, see, there is a term without n, which is just minus I over lambda times integral of lambda. That's just this term here. Right? And then how do I integrate out n?
Fourier.
But even simple Fourier, that's a good point. That's good. Yeah, we will use Fourier to compute explicitly. But what is, why can I integrate out n? Is it obvious, is it trivial that I can integrate n out? If instead of n squared minus 1, if it was n to the 4 minus 1, I could not. So why can I integrate out? It's really because it's n squared, not n to the 4 or n to the 6.
Because the kinetic term can be neglected using the...
No. Kinetic term is important. It is just... Yeah,
it's Gaussian.
Because it's Gaussian. It's n squared. It's just quadratic in n. So it's quadratic in n. So what it gives is determinant of that operator, right? Determinant, and how many components n has? It has n components. So we get plus n over 2 times log, because I put it in the exponent, 1 over 1 half because it's square root of determinant, and n because there are n scalars, log of the determinant of the operator box minus lambda. Okay, so now I'm not being very careful with overall constants, but that's what it. Let's do Euclidean, just otherwise I'll get some factors wrong for sure. So here I change to Euclidean now. Now, the key observation is, look, if n is very large, this action is very large. So we can actually compute it by saddle point. We can actually say that because this action is very large, lambda will want to go to its minimum value and stay there. Because moving away from that value costs a lot of energy. So if lambda is very large, lambda goes to the saddle point of this equation. Of the variation of this effective action with respect to lambda equal to zero, right? Which gives me what? From the first term, I get minus 1 over lambda. And from the second term, I get plus the derivative with respect to lambda of log that box plus lambda with some n over 2 here. Now, log that, I remind you, is the same as trace log. Is this clear? Log that equals trace log. You have seen it, yeah, in GR, in quantum field theory, and so on. trace, I can go to a Bayes in Fourier, take derivative, so I'll write what the result for this is, and you tell me if you agree. This will be integral d to p. The integral is nothing but the trace. Derivative of the log gives me 1 over box plus this, which in Fourier is p squared plus lambda. And therefore, this is what I get. OK? Is it clear? And this quantity is what? If I write d to p, if I go to spherical coordinates, is 2 pi times p dp, right? So I can do the integral, and I get, let me tell you, and you tell me if you agree, 2 pi log, at large p, this diverges logarithmically, because this is p dp over p squared, so at large p, it goes like 1 over p. So there is a log, and I need to put a cutoff at large p, which I will call lambda QCD. It's a bit funny because we are studying a sigma model, but I like to call it lambda QCD because it's the analog of the cutoff that we would get in QCD. And the lower integration is when p equal to 0, which is controlled by lambda. Okay? Is it clear? So what we conclude, what we get from here, if we equate this equation, is that lambda is equal to lambda QCD, this cutoff value, exponential of minus 1 over 4 pi lambda n. Okay. Now, in fact, let me put some expectation value of lambda in the sense to indicate this is the value at the saddle point. So I'll put some expectation value symbol there. Okay. Now, I would like to make a few comments. So see, lambda is the coupling, and what do we get here? E to the minus 1 over lambda. It's weird, right? It doesn't have a Taylor expansion in lambda. If I try to ask what's its expectation value as a series expansion in lambda, it doesn't have a series expansion in lambda. It's an unperturbative effect. This is really non-perturbative. So what we are observing here is a phenomenon called dynamical mass transmutation, which is a non-perturbative effect. By which we transformed a coupling lambda, which was not physical, in an expectation lambda that, as I will tell you now, is physical and is what is giving mass to these particles n. Okay? But the point is that, indeed, so what we conclude is that we can go to the original action now. We can go to the original action. And in the original action, replace lambda by this expectation value of lambda plus fluctuations. We know this is a good approximation if n is large. If n is not large, it's not totally justified what we did. But if n is large, it's great. And when we do it, what do we get? We get integral d to x dn square plus m square n square plus the fluctuation part, where m square is exactly that quantity there, lambda e to the minus 1 over 4 pi lambda n. So this is why, you see, but now m clearly has the meaning of mass for this particle n. So we conclude that in this model, the particles, they have some mass, which is then generated by non-perturbative effects. It's purely quantumly generated. Okay, you see that when lambda is very small, this is super small. It's a very, very small mass when the coupling is small, right? Very, very, very small mass. And why is it very, very small? Because you see, normally, we could have expected to get massless particles because we could say we have a vector in a sphere. So let the vector be pointing in the North Pole. How much energy does it cost to point in another direction? Zero, because all directions are the same. So going from a configuration where everyone is up to everyone being there, or everyone being there, or everyone being there, should cost zero energy to move. So this is the idea that we should have Goldstone bosons, particles that cost zero energy and that move us for free in a moduli space. In higher dimensions, that would be a correct conclusion. Indeed, because we spontaneously break the symmetry, we have massless particles corresponding to moving in these flat directions. But in two dimensions, there are no Goldstone bosons. In two dimensions, there is a theorem of Wigner and someone else that says that there are no Goldstone bosons. And what we are seeing here is exactly that. The particles, they are not massless, they could not be. They have a mass which is very, very small, but it's generated by quantum non-perturbative quantum effects, and it's approximately equal to this. It's not exactly equal to this, because n, in principle, could be 4 or 5 or 6. It's not infinite. But if n was infinite, it would be exact. Okay? So what is the answer for what are particles here? Just to conclude. So particles here, the way to draw them is to say that I have a line and I have a bump. It moves with some momentum p. The energy of p is square root of p square plus m square. So it's a particle with this non-perturbative mass that was generated. So we had a lambda, now we get an m, which is physical. But I should say something else. The particle is not a point. It's rather a vector, right? The particle has a vector, which means it has a component, j. It has a flavor, if you want, that runs from 1 to n. Okay? Which in pictures, if you like group theory, you would say that on, I have a vector, right, vj, which corresponds to saying that I have a single box. If you are familiar with this language of representation, where a box represents a vector, two boxes represent this would be anti-symmetric. Combination of two indices, this would be symmetric combination of two indices, and so on. This would be what particles are. Particles are a box, and that's it. Now, this is quite non-trivial. We were lucky that here, by using this trick of large N, we could find what particles are, or have a good guess. We could be wrong, because it's strongly coupled, but it's a good guess. Particles transform in the vector representation of On. A priori, if I would just give me this field theory, I would say, I don't know what particles are. They are some objects that move, and they transform in some representation of On. And without solving the theory, I don't even know which representation it is. I could say maybe the vector, because it's the simplest, but who knows? Could be the triple antisymmetric representation of On, right? I would just not know. Here, because of these tricks of large N, we could get some intuition and hope that, well, if it's true for large N, perhaps for N equal 5 or 6 or 4 or 3, it's also true. It's probably just they transform in the vector representation. Okay? I'm out of time, but I have one more blackboard to fill, so I will just conclude with one last example. Just to illustrate that what I'm saying is not academic. Sometimes we can indeed have examples where understanding what are particles is really not obvious at all. Another famous model is what is called the SUN principal chiral field. This Lagrangian is given by, you take by the trace of dg, dg minus 1, where g is an element of SUN. It's a group element of SUN. Okay? So an element of SUN is a manifold, right? You take an element of SUN, it's a manifold. Do you agree? For example, if it's SU2, the manifold is actually a sphere. But if it's SU3, SU4, it's a manifold, right? And this is an action on that manifold. It's the most natural action on that manifold, right? It's putting a particle on that manifold, which is the group manifold, okay? Now, this theory, what is the symmetry of this theory? Can someone tell me a symmetry of this theory? So let me point out that this symmetry has On symmetry. If I rotate N, the action is invariant. N goes to lambda N, leaves this vector, this scalar product invariant. So this action has On symmetry. Now, can someone tell me a symmetry of this section here?
S-U-N,
how do I see this symmetry?
Multiply G with a G0.
Very good. So there, this model has a symmetry where G goes to G. How do I multiply it?
Let's say G prime.
G times H, where H is a constant matrix of S-U-N. This is invariant because indeed, right? So G minus 1 would go to H minus 1, G minus 1, and therefore the H and H minus 1 would cancel and the action would be invariant. Do you agree? But it's actually also invariant if I multiply by through the left, where this is also a constant matrix of SUN because the trace is cyclic, so by the same reason it's also invariant. So this theory actually as SUN left times SUN right symmetry. It has two SUN. I can multiply by the left and by the right. So what are particles in this theory? Particles transform into some representation of SUN left and SUN right. Right? So when I think of a particle, I should ask myself, what happens when I act with the symmetry of SUN left? What happens when I act with the symmetry of SUN right? Right? Under which representations do particles transform? Okay, so here is the answer. A particle will have some momentum p and some mass m. Okay, and here is how it transforms. I can think of it as now two vectors and one of them in the fundamental of SUN is just a vector of SUN, and the other one transforming in the vector of SUN. So each particle has an index A and A prime, where A and A prime transform as fundamentals of SUN. Right? Is it clear? But there is more. There is another particle, which I will draw with a slightly bigger vector. This I would call M1. This I would say it has some momentum p and some mass m2, where they transform in the antisymmetric representation, m, a vector ab, times antisymmetric representation. This also exists, where a particle, under the left, you have an index ab, and on the right, a prime b prime, which are totally antisymmetric, each of them. Okay? So this notation is for V, A, B, where these guys are antisymmetric. Okay. And there's also another case where they are bigger and they transform in the triplet with three indices plus dot, dot, dot until the last case where they have n minus 1 because this is the most you can have. In SUN, you can only antisymmetrize n minus 1 times. Like in SU2, you cannot antisymmetrize. Right? In SU3, you can antisymmetrize. Right? N minus 1 times the same thing. And the mass, this mass m, n, where n is the number of boxes, you see 1, 2, 3, is given by some constant m times sine of n pi over n. It should be the same when n equals 1, and for this and this, it should be the same value. So I want 1 here, and here.
Just
1
over n?
Yeah, it's good. Where the masses, they are distributed like this. So if you plot the mass as function of the number of boxes of the representation where they transform, it's a sign. This is the lightest particle, next to lightest, ta ta ta. The heaviest is when you have half as many boxes as you can have, and so on. And this theory has all this zoo of particles, And there is no simple large N argument that would tell you this. Here it really is hardcore, much more complicated technology we would have to use, even to guess for these strongly coupled field theories, what are the quantum particles of the theory. Here is the solution. They transform, there are N minus one type of particles. They have this mass spectrum, and they transform under that representation. Okay, so let me conclude with three questions that give you a flavor of the kind of things we are going to do. So a big question is, we saw this nice spectrum of theories with particles in various different incarnations, strongly coupled particles with some large N, spinons, magnons, solitons, and so on. And the question is that we can ask is, how do we solve these theories? How do we take these theories and solve them and start studying their physics? And here are some sub-questions that are simpler and that I would like to address in the remaining lectures. Okay? One is, what are these spinons that have spin 1/2? So what are they? How do we think of these spinons? Another question is, these Lagrangians, for example, this Lagrangian of Sine-Gordon, where does it come from, and is it special? Are there some special theories with some nice Lagrangians like this that we can understand? And the question number three is related to this ON sigma model. Okay, now we know what particles are, but still it's a strongly coupled field theory. How do we solve it? And there's something called the bootstrap. Bootstrap is the idea that you push yourself from your bootstraps and you lift yourself in the air. So you need to be very, very strong. And the idea is to use some very basic physical principles that allow us to lift ourselves and solve the theory, even though the theory is strongly coupled. So my hope would be to do lecture 1, lecture 2, lecture 3. This is very ambitious for lecture 1. So this will be lecture 2 and 3. This would be perhaps lecture 4. And we have no lecture for this. I'll probably steal a lecture from Kevin next week, but I didn't tell him yet. Don't tell him. But my guess is that I will need to steal one more lecture from him. Finally, just for tomorrow, because we are going to use it, I would like you to do the following exercise, which is kind of embarrassing because it's basically related to the factors of two that I was getting wrong. But the exercise is to show that when you have this sigma n dot sigma n plus 1 minus the identity, that you can write this as the permutation operator that swaps spins at positions n and n plus 1 minus twice the identity. Right? So this permutation operator acts on two spins and swaps them. So in this case, up's down. And if it's up, it does nothing. Okay? So it's a simple exercise. So please do this simple exercise for tomorrow. Thank you.